Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you are involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. I'm Bill Miller. Today, we're going to be taking a look at some really hot spots in the world and see if we can develop some suggestions as to how to overcome some of these problems. My guest today is an expert on many of these areas. Mr. John Pfeffer is the author of Splinterlands, and he is currently the director of the Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John Pfeffer, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate you being with me. John, we're going to get into some hot spots in just a second, but what is the IPS, the Institute of for Policy Studies, mm-hmm. I should say?
Institute for Policy Studies is a think tank, a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. It was formed in 1963, and it serves as a kind of connection between social movements, popular movements, and legislation and policymakers in Washington, D.C. And I head up something called Foreign Policy and Focus, which is a website devoted to kind of critical looks at U.S. foreign policy and world affairs.
Very good. And our viewers can go to your website at www.ips-dc.org for more information. Yes. Well, let's just jump right into it. So often we make comparisons of various administrations in the United States of their foreign policies. For example, George W. Bush's administration versus Barack Obama. Summing up very quickly, how would you identify the approach that Joe Biden takes to foreign policy as opposed to the approach that Donald Trump took?
Mm-hmm. So Joe Biden basically subscribes to something we call liberal internationalism. It's more or less the mainstream consensus that has prevailed in the United States. One could argue certainly since the end of the Cold War, but for large portions of the Cold War as well, which says the United States should be engaged in the world, largely on behalf of our allies and against our adversaries, but also participating in international institutions, the United Nations, World Trade Organization, in order to kind of gain strategic advantage and for ourselves and for our allies. Donald Trump departed from this consensus with what might be called illiberal internationalism. In other words, he was not isolationist entirely, although there were some aspects of isolationism to his approach. In other words, focusing more on the homeland, if you will, as opposed to foreign policy. But Trump also had a version of internationalism. He had his allies, which tended to be authoritarian leaders in other countries, Vladimir Putin in Russia, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. And he also projected, of course, a very strong military, increased military spending in the United States, wanted to militarize the border between the United States and Mexico. So those are basically the two principal types of approach to international affairs: liberal internationalism of Biden, illiberal internationalism of Trump.
Well, there's so many hot spots around the world, and one of the hottest right now is the war between basically Hamas and Israel. And of course, we saw what happened, the horrific invasion of October 7th, the massacre. But by the same token, now we're seeing the pendulum seems to swing in the opposite direction. Israel had the world really behind it on October 8th, but it's lost a lot of that. The war has been handled. No matter what we say today, it'll be out of date tomorrow, probably. But how do you view the situation and what can be done to bring stability and peace to that area, or at least, at the very least, a ceasefire?
Of course. So what we see right now is Israel trying to accomplish its objective of destroying Hamas. And basically bombing the Gaza Strip, a very narrow strip between Israel and Egypt, into rubble. And as a byproduct, killing over 30,000 people, 70% of which are civilians, women and children, and displacing over 1 million people, many of whom have crowded into the southernmost part of Gaza, a city called Rafah. And right now, Israel has pledged to kind of continue its military assault in Rafah, which is now an overcrowded enclave, unless Hamas releases the remaining Israeli hostages that it and other organizations seized on October 7th. The United States and other countries have pressed for a ceasefire. Some of the calls from other countries have been a little bit more forthright in supporting the interests of Palestinians during this process. The United States continues to support Israel militarily and diplomatically, but the Biden administration has basically called for a short ceasefire of at least 6 weeks in order for there to be an exchange of hostages and prisoners and for some humanitarian relief operations to proceed. And that's the standoff we have right now. I think the United States really has to recognize that it has to work with other partners on this, especially in the Arab world. The Biden administration has tried to orchestrate a deal with Saudi Arabia and Israel, trading diplomatic recognition for kind of a ceasefire and then support for a Palestinian state. It's hard to know how far that will go, but that clearly, a ceasefire and recognition of Palestinian state is where most of the world is right now. And in order for some kind of pressure to be put on Israel to accept a ceasefire, the United States is going to have to, I think, apply the pressure a little bit more strongly on the Netanyahu administration in Israel.
Yeah, it's becoming very obvious that President Biden is going to have to do something to really break what's going on in that area of the world. Because, of course, a lot of the foreign policy experts have said, well, if Biden had not been involved, Netanyahu would have gone absolutely insane and may have flattened Gaza within a few days. So Biden may have been a voice of moderation and held him back a little bit, but something is going to have to give because of the horrible destruction. And of course, we've seen over 30,000 people have been killed in the Gaza Strip area. But do you think, is there any possibility, we keep talking about a two-state solution, is that still feasible, even though Benjamin Netanyahu says he would never have a two-state solution?
It has become increasingly unlikely, not only because of Israeli opposition largely from Netanyahu and his right-wing allies and his administration, but also because the very kind of material basis for an independent state is quickly slipping away. Israel has destroyed much of Gaza, occupied it effectively, and the Netanyahu government has not talked about restoring any kind of Palestinian governance in that area, but has talked more of kind of an occupation authority, something the United States has opposed, but to no avail. And even in the West Bank, settlers have on the ground launched dozens and dozens of attacks against Palestinian households and farms since October 7th, seizing territory and terrorizing the population. So even that kind of territory that could be part of a Palestinian state is becoming smaller and smaller. So, for any independent Palestinian state to be feasible, it will be necessary to restore the Gaza Strip to Palestinian governance and to roll back some of the settler gains, if you will, territorial occupations that have taken place not only since October 7th, but prior to that as well. If that can happen, and that will, of course, be fiercely opposed by some segments of Israeli society, then yes, I think it is possible to have a Palestinian state in the future.
Over the years, the decades, really since the United Nations set up Israel and Palestine back in 1947 and it came online in 48, there have been a wide range of aid provided to that area of the world. One group that has really, I think, done a Herculean job has been UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Work Agency. And now it's been discovered, or it's been alleged, let's say that, that 13 of the 13,000 UNRWA employees have been sympathetic to Hamas. It's not been proven, but Secretary General has fired all of them, and they're doing an investigation of UNRWA. But today, it seems like we've had a knee-jerk reaction from the United States and some of the donors to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in that they want to defund it and they want to break it up and parcel it out to UNICEF and the World Food Program, who are both excellent agencies, but it's not quite the same as having a centralized agency that can provide health, educational, occupational training, those types of things to folks. How do you view that situation?
Well, there has been a concerted effort in the United States to defund UNRWA, and that was indeed what the Trump administration attempted to do. Some of that funding and authority was restored when Biden took office. The allegations of connections between UNRWA staff and Hamas, well, hard for me to weigh in on that, but I can say that, as you said, there are 13,000 UNRWA employees. That's an enormous number of people. And anybody doing humanitarian or relief operations in Gaza, they're going to have to work with Hamas. Hamas is a kind of three-part creature. It's not only a paramilitary organization, it's also a political party and a governing party for many years. But the third part is it's a charitable organization, a social service organization involved in every tier of Palestinian society. If you're going to be providing assistance, you're going to have to engage with Hamas at some level. So that's just a reality. And that's going to be a reality going forward, even though, at least in Netanyahu's mind, he thinks he can destroy Hamas. He might be able to destroy it formally, but as an organization, it will continue in some form or another.
Very true. You may get some of the Hamas fighters, but to destroy a concept or a terroristic idea is very difficult, if not impossible, to do. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We would invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous programs. Also, if you're involved with a PBS or community access television station, or perhaps an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or you have a website, or you just have a computer and you like our show and you would like to share it, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're taking a look at some of the hotspots around the world, such as Ukraine, the Middle East, and other places, to see if we can get an update on what's happening and also maybe provide suggestions on how to quell some of the problems in that area or those areas. My guest today is Mr. John Pfeffer. John Pfeffer is the author of Splinterlands. He is currently the director of the Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, we've talked about Israel. We could talk about that horrific situation for hours, probably. Let's shift over to Ukraine. Right now, the Ukrainians are back on their heels, primarily because the Republicans in Congress and one of the presidential candidates, Donald Trump, do not want to fund Ukraine. What can be done to help the Ukrainians and to really stop the advance of the Russians? And it's been slow, but they're starting to actually gain more ground now that the funding, a large part of it, has been cut off.
Well, the Ukrainians basically need two things at this point. They need military hardware and they need military fighters or soldiers. There's not much we can do here in the United States to help on the soldier front, and we have no intention of committing troops to this conflict. So that's a challenge that the Ukrainians have to somehow solve themselves, possibly by lowering the age of enlistment from 27 to 25. But the other question, military hardware, is certainly something we can help with and which we have promised to help with. And indeed, there are even Republicans who are very much in favor of helping Ukraine. We had a bill passed in the Senate with considerable Republican support that would provide billions and billions of dollars to Ukraine. That bill has not made it into the House. It has been kind of stopped by the Speaker of the House, who is, at least according to his own words, in support of Ukraine as well, but is listening to legislators further to the right, MAGA Republicans, as well as Donald Trump himself, who has opposed further assistance to Ukraine. It looks as if this bill will pass. It has certainly enough votes. It's just a question of being introduced. The Speaker of the House has talked about dividing up the current proposal into two bills, one that supports Israel, one that supports Ukraine. Not sure how that would go over exactly. But then there are also efforts afoot among Republicans and Democrats to kind of go around the House Speaker's authority in order to get the legislation introduced. If it gets introduced, it will likely pass. But so far, these efforts to go around the Speaker of the House have not gained sufficient number of votes. So that's really the kind of key thing here. Is assisting Ukraine, giving it also some diplomatic support for its efforts to try to join the European Union. Though that's at this point, I think what can be done.
It's certainly a quagmire, and it's one that we're going to have to overcome very, very quickly. And hopefully there will be some movement. And you're right, there are Republicans in the Senate who are very supportive, and there are many in the House who are supportive, but they can't vote on the bill because Speaker Johnson has pretty much indicated he's not going to put it up. Well, there's so many problems in this world. And of course, the United States, even though it has made mistakes in the past, and we will in the future, I'm sure, is still the leader in dealing with so many of these, along with the United Nations. One article I noticed that you had, and you do a wonderful publication about once a week, as I recall, and one is an article on deconstructing World War III. What was the background on that, and what did you mean by deconstructing World War III or eliminating the new Iron Curtain?
Yeah. So at the moment, the United States is in some pretty significant conflict with Russia, obviously over the war in Ukraine, with China as well, largely over trade and high technology. And effectively, a kind of new Iron Curtain is starting to materialize, with Russia and China coming, of course, closer together, China supplying some assistance to Russia for its effort in Ukraine, but more importantly, buying things that Russia has to sell, namely energy, and also selling things to Russia that it can't get any longer from other countries because of sanctions. Throw in Iran, kind of a major player in the Middle East, which also has its kind of complicated relationship with the United States. And you have a rather powerful set of countries kind of arrayed against what might be called the collective West. Now, I would say that we're in a period right now in which the Iron Curtain hasn't been established. It's being slowly constructed. So I would compare it to, say, 1946, when we still had some measure of cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union, but it was rapidly disappearing. I think it's possible to avoid the construction of an Iron Curtain now, especially by canny US diplomats who recognize that if we do, in fact, improve our relations with both China and Iran, we can diminish their reliance or their solidarity with Russia. With Iran, of course, we've had a nuclear agreement in the past. It's, basically on life support at the moment. Very difficult to resurrect it, but it is possible. And I would hope that a Biden administration, either now or perhaps a second term, would put a lot of political capital into repairing relations with Iran, even though right now we don't have a reformist leadership there, but a rather conservative leadership as a result, largely, of what Trump did during his 4 years in office. With China, it's a little bit more complicated because it's across a number of different issues. But I do think it is possible for the United States and China to recognize that they have considerable overlapping interests, especially on energy, technology, and climate, and that rather than engaging in what is effectively a trade war right now, it would be best for both sides to step back, to kind of put their national interests first and foremost, and identify those areas of cooperation, for instance, in clean energy production, that would benefit not only the two countries, but of course the rest of the world as well. By pursuing that strategy, essentially of repairing relations with Iran, improving relations with China, that would also result in greater isolation for Russia and make it more difficult for them to prosecute the war in Ukraine. That, I think, is the most effective way of learning from our past mistakes. And, in 1946, we embarked on a Cold War that would last until effectively 1989, 1990, so a good 40 years. We're at that point now, and we could avoid a similar 40-year Cold War with these major countries, but it will require some, as I said, rather innovative diplomacy coming from Washington.
It certainly will, and it's everyone's advantage. There are so many needs in every country of the world, really. And to put our money into a defense department, or where they're talking about now, trillions of dollars into refurbishing our nuclear stockpile, which is absolutely ridiculous. We've got these weapons that are costing at least $150 million a day just to maintain. And hopefully we will never use them, because we do. That's the end of the planet. There's no doubt about that. But we have other things we need to be doing. But this brings to mind the novel that you wrote, your dystopian novel titled Splinterlands. And you describe a world where superpowers are splintered, they've fractured. The global economy is teetering, although our economy is doing very well. And the global economy is not too bad right now. But there are other things such as climate change, the glaciers are melting, the seas are rising. There's this violent ultra-nationalism. We're seeing it in the United States, in Hungary, and in other countries of the world. Do you see a parallel between what you describe very prophetically and really some of the conditions that existed prior to World War I? Come right down to it. But the world is at a very dangerous point, and a lot of the leaders are not really working to try to overcome some of these problems.
Your comparison to World War I, I think, is very apt. I mean, prior to World War I, you had one of the most profound movements towards the creation of a global economy, a global community, the construction of telegraph wires that would tie countries together. Shipping that served as the backbone for the global economy, the emergence of effectively an international community that wasn't actually formalized into an international community until after World War I, but World War I destroyed all of that, set the world back many steps in terms of creating the conditions for international cooperation. We have also had a period of expanding globalization, some of it good, some of it bad, but certainly at the political diplomatic level, the strengthening of institutions like the United Nations and all of its associated bodies. And that, at the moment, is potentially on the verge of dissolution. The very bonds that hold countries together are being threatened effectively by far-right nationalist leaders who say, we don't want the international community, you people in Brussels, you people in Washington, you people in wherever, telling us what to do. We want to have complete control over everything that takes place within our borders. That's certainly the argument that Vladimir Putin makes. It's the argument that Xi Jinping has often made. But you see it as well with Narendra Modi or Viktor Orban or Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. All these people I would call sovereignistas, in other words, people who insist on a sovereign right to control what goes on in their country. And Generally speaking, they're not talking about participatory democracies. They're not talking about their citizenry controlling what goes on in their countries. They're talking about themselves. They're talking about the sovereign, the king, or the equivalent in their countries controlling what's going on. So it's a profoundly anti-liberal, anti-democratic, and anti-international approach to things. And Donald Trump, I think, is one of the leading characters in this drama. So the international community stands at a crossroads, whether it continues to become, a force for good in the world and solving the major global problems that face us, from climate change to endemic economic inequality in the world, or whether the bonds that hold us disappear and the world becomes ever more fragmented and ever more incapable of solving common problems.
And we've seen that the two major wars in our, well, any place in the world have been held in Europe, and also because of the conditions that you were talking about. The isolationist approach plays well, sounds good, totally irrational, totally impractical. It does not work, and there's no way you can cut yourself off what's going on in other parts of the world, and to say, well, we don't have to worry about the Ukrainians or what happens with the Israelis. Those do not impact our lives, but they do. And what we really need to do is, I look at a lot of news outlets every day. My own biased opinion on this, if you want to call it that, is that we need to stop listening to some of the far right wing, really, spinners of misinformation, disinformation, and outright lies, and start looking for actual factual information and start working together to overcome these problems. But John Pfeffer, we'll have to deal with the rest of the world at a later date. But I want to thank you so very much for a very interesting and a very informative program.
Thank you for having me on the show. I look forward to future conversations.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure. I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.